I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She's 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now, multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year, and they can't do it without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250, baby. Or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core with Walker Waubman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for joining us today. I'm going to just pick up where we left off with Thanksgiving. You know, had a great Thanksgiving. Hope you did as well. And last week on Tuesday and Thursday, we dove back into biblical citizenship in modern America, but we didn't get very far. I was reading Thanksgiving proclamations and talking about all kinds of other things. So we're going to pick up where we left off last Thursday. We had to interrupt in the middle of our week five lesson from biblical citizenship in modern America. It's called Who Has Authority? So a lot of this is all about who has jurisdiction, who gets to make the decision. So let's dive right back in where we left off last week. This is biblical citizenship in modern America.
Should address this whole idea of the Constitution alive, all right? We want to bring the Constitution alive. That doesn't mean we believe in this living, breathing document theory that a lot of people have out there. That's really the two different views of the Constitution. You have guys like Souter on the court and others that say, oh, it's a living, breathing document, which means it needs to change with the times and change with the people. And I have to change it because I'm on the Supreme Court. So if 5 of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court decide to change something in the Constitution, well, it's alive and we can do that. No. Constitution alive means that this document is still alive. It is still applicable today to our lives.
Yeah, this was back several years ago. The state school superintendent in Georgia came to me and he knew that we had been educating people on the Constitution, on our founding, on the Declaration of Independence. And he felt that students in Georgia were not really getting that well educated on the Constitution, our Declaration, et cetera. And so he wanted to do a video project that was professionally done, and he got Georgia Public Broadcasting to actually do the filming of this short feature. This, I think it's about 15 minutes, called It's My Constitution. And it still plays on September the 17th, or as close to it as possible, when Georgia actually recognizes Constitution Day. They play that in every school, or at least they're supposed to. And the whole aspect of that was to engage with young people to say, this isn't the government's constitution, it's your constitution. It's your constitution because you ultimately are in control of this government. And if you don't know what the government is supposed to be doing, then the government will actually run over you. Because the constitution is for you to control the government, not the government to control you. And that's really the message that we're trying to get across to young people in Georgia and across America, is this doesn't spell out all of your rights. God has given you those rights. This identifies some of those rights, but more importantly, it puts limits on the government so that the government doesn't violate your rights. And it spells out that it's the government's role and primary responsibility to protect your rights.
But back to what Hamilton said about general welfare, because we want to judge general welfare based on these guys, not what our congressman says today or what the court might say today or what some professor says or what I say. It's what these guys said that matters. So here's what Hamilton said about general welfare. He said, the welfare of the community of states is the only legitimate end for which money can be raised from the community. So if you go back to the phrase that we were just reading, let's jump back over there to Article 1, Section 8, page 12 and 13. So 13 if you're looking at the Constitution Made Easy, 12 if you're looking at the original. So to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So he's saying the only thing that the federal government can raise money for is for a general purpose. So here's what he goes on to say. So if it's going to be raised from the community, the only legitimate end for which money can be raised from the community, Congress can be considered as only under one restriction, which does not apply to other governments. They cannot rightfully apply the money they raise to any purpose, merely or purely local. The constitutional test of a right application must always be whether it's for a purpose of general, meaning this is for the whole system, or local nature. So if Congress spends money that's for the whole system, then he's saying, even Hamilton, who later becomes kind of the liberal, if you will, of the founding fathers as he tries to expand the power of Congress, he's saying that when they raise money, the only proper function would be for a general purpose for everybody, not for a local purpose. So the bridge to nowhere, or you know, a general purpose would be the interstate system for the nation to allow the free flow of commerce. That you can make an argument for is a general purpose. But for a bridge to 24 people that costs however many hundreds of millions of dollars that thing costs, obviously that's a local nature, and Hamilton would say that's not a proper use of this phrase, general welfare. Here's Madison's description. I love this. It's brought it so into focus for me to understand the difference between general welfare the way people define it today and general welfare the way the guys that sat in this room, the way they defined it. Here's Madison. He said, consider for a moment the immeasurable difference between the Constitution limited in its powers. Now that's what they did, the bucket with the lid on it, if you will. Constitution limited in its powers to the enumerated objects and expounded, or if you would, or expounded, as it would be by the import claim for the phraseology in question. Now, the letter he's writing here is in a debate over the question of general welfare. And he's saying, if you define it as the bucket with the lid on it, if you define it the way these guys define it, as limited in its powers to the enumerated objects, or expounded as it would be, as they wanted general welfare to mean, he said, man, the difference, he probably didn't say man, I don't think that Madison talked like that, but anyway, the difference is equivalent to two constitutions. So we have two totally different things here. Characters essentially contrasted with each other, the one possessing powers confined to certain specific areas or cases, the bucket with the lid on it, the other extended to all cases whatsoever. That's two totally different constitutions. And then he asked the question of whether or not these guys in this room would have ever gone for this expanded to any cases whatsoever. Look at how he puts it. He said, can less be said than that it is impossible that such a constitution as the latter, this expanded to be anything, would have been recommended to the states by all the members of that body whose names were subscribed to the instrument, the men that sat in this room in 1787. He's saying it is impossible that these guys would have signed that constitution, and he would know he was here. He was one of them. Is it credible that such a power would have been unnoticed and unopposed in the federal convention? This is the constitutional convention that took place here. And then he takes it even further than that. Not only would these guys have never gone for this expanded government into anything, not only were these guys adamant about the bucket having a lid on it, he goes back home to the states for the ratification. Listen to this. In the state conventions, which contended for and proposed restrictive and explanatory amendments, now, and he's talking, of course, about the Bill of Rights, right? Because those state conventions are where all those ideas emanated from. They debated them and they talked about them, those great debates between Madison and Patrick Henry and Virginia and all the other debates. He said, even in those state conventions, where they came up with the amendments that would ultimately go into the Constitution, he's saying those guys would have never dreamed general welfare would mean what people wanted to mean today. And then he said, in the Congress of 1787, so think about the progression here. You got what happened in this room, okay? So we got the Constitutional Convention itself. He said, never. No way would those guys have gone for general welfare. They wanted enumerated, limited powers, lid on the bucket. Congress, the state conventions that ratified what happened in here, at all those state conventions, they would have never gone for general welfare. I mean, and that they wanted the lid on the bucket. And then in Congress, the first Congress in 1789 that adopts the 10 amendments that came from those states, they would have never gone for general welfare. He's saying in all three cases, he says a power to impose unlimited taxes for unlimited purposes could never have escaped those public bodies. All three of them, this room and the others as well. Now, listen to his summation, because I think it's great. He says, the Constitution is a limited one. possessing no power not actually given. Now, even a country boy from Dripping Springs can understand that. No power not actually given. There is no power in the Constitution that is not actually given. So the bucket, we gave them these powers, we put a lid on it. We cannot let them add power to that. Why? Why did those guys sit in this room and for months debate the smallest thing? I mean, look, they listed every little thing they wanted the federal government. Turn the page there and look at that. Post offices and post roads. They even took the time to list that they could build roads. Now, friends, it was the middle of the summer in Philadelphia. It was hot. Man, they had the windows shut off, the doors closed, didn't want anybody listening to what they were doing. They were wearing those, you know, 15 layers of clothes they wore back then. These guys were sweating it out, let me tell you. And here they are in that heat, sweating it out, and they're willing to take the time to list every little thing that Congress could do. Why? Why would they do that? I'm asking, why would they do that? Limited government and a distrust. What's the rest of that quote say? Carrying on the face of it a distrust of power. These guys didn't trust power any more than you and I do. They understood the nature of man, the depravity of man, that if you give power to somebody, Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is evil, no man can know it. These guys said that's why they wanted separation of power, because the heart is evil, no man can know it. So we didn't want to put too much power in anybody's hands. And in fact, we wanted to define very carefully what that power was and put every little thing in writing. Everything in the bucket is in writing right here. That's why they did it for us, friends. Enumerated powers, we've lost that concept in America. We've got to teach the rising generation to be free. And the way we do that is we give them the details. We show them exactly what the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do. Now, we're not going to have time to go through every one of those powers, but there's a couple of examples I want to run through here. Now, general welfare, by the way, have you noticed that's kind of become a loophole? That's become a loophole so big you can drive a Mack truck through it. I mean, that has become a phrase you hear over and over and over again from members of Congress, that they have the power to do something because of general welfare. Well, you know, there's some other loopholes. What would you guess out of the Constitution are some other phrases that have become loopholes for the federal government to get around those limits? What would you say is
necessary and proper?
Necessary and proper clause. Exactly right. One more. What's another big one?
Public good.
Public good. Absolutely. Then there's one that actually, that healthcare, they tried to cram healthcare through. What's that one?
Interstate trade.
Interstate trade, but we call it the
Commerce Clause.
Now let's say it all together.
Commerce Clause.
That's right. Okay, so the Commerce Clause is another. So you got necessary and proper clause for good, the general welfare, the Commerce Clause. I mean, these have become loopholes that they shove anything into instead of sticking with the bucket. So the best way for us as citizens to close the loophole is to go back to those words in the Constitution and say, well, what did they really mean? We already did general welfare. What did they mean by Commerce Clause? What did they mean by necessary and proper? What did those things really mean? Let's look at and I'm gonna skip over, well, I won't skip over. This next clause there, if you're on page 12 where we're going through the enumerated powers, I know we don't like it. I don't like these $1 trillion deficits, friends. I think they're immoral, I think they're wrong. Unfortunately, they are constitutional. And that phrase says to borrow money on the credit of the United States. They have, it's one of the powers we put in the bucket. And of course, we want them to be able to fight wars. At some time, you might have to, you know how close we were to amending that part of the Constitution? We almost had a balanced budget amendment, 1999. Anybody know? How close were we?
One.
You got it right there, ma'am. One vote. One vote. We could have had it with one more vote. Don't tell me your vote doesn't count. Every vote counts, every single time. I think we've got a lot of momentum in the country right now. That's probably an amendment we can get done if we put enough support behind it. But anyway, it is obviously constitutional for them to borrow money right now. Let's rein that one in. But here's the Commerce Clause, okay? So here's this next big loophole that they run through. I see three areas right here that the federal government has the power, we gave them or loaned them the power to regulate three areas of commerce. Now, regulate does not mean micromanage. Back then, it meant to make regular. So it doesn't mean they get to micromanage it. It means they actually get to make it regular, which is back to this idea of general welfare. It's back to the idea of protecting the system itself. And in commerce, what's the system you want to protect? The free flow of free enterprise, right? So in order to do that, we gave them the power to be the negotiators, if you will, in these three areas of commerce. Three areas only. Number one, we said they can regulate commerce with foreign nations. We already mentioned we don't want 50 states negotiating with these countries and having 50 different treaties. So we let the federal government do that. Fair enough. Second category, and among the several states, as Thomas said, that's interstate commerce. So that interstate commerce that crosses a state line, you could say that the federal camel nose is under the tent. We gave them, loaned them the power to, in some way, make regular commerce across state lines. Now, that doesn't mean micromanage. What it means is we're not going to let one state abuse another state in terms of free enterprise. For instance, in Texas, we've really, over the last few decades, increased our agriculture in the area of vineyards and having wineries all around Texas, and it's actually become a big part of our agriculture. Well, California, obviously huge in that, right? Well, Texas legislature cannot pass a law that says, well, we really want to help these guys with these vineyards in Texas be able to do better in their sales, so Texans can't buy California wine anymore. We're going to impose a blockade. That's why we want a commerce clause in the Constitution, so that the federal government can say to Texas, no, you can't do that. We want the free flow of commerce because we believe in the free market. And we believe that if you allow that free market to flow, everybody's going to be better off. So that's a legitimate function of the federal government. And then the last category with the Indian tribes. So you've got sovereign Indian tribes. You ought to have the nation of the United States negotiating with them and not all these individual states in terms of the commerce. So there's your three categories: foreign nations, interstate commerce, and your Indian tribe.
All right, quick break, everybody. We'll be back to talk more about the Commerce Clause. It's actually one of the most important amendments we could make to the Constitution. We fix the Commerce Clause, we can wipe out a couple of hundred federal agencies that should have never existed in the first place. Stay with us. You're listening to At the Core with Walker Waldman and Rick Green. We're listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Waldman and Rick Green, jumping right back into Biblical Citizenship and Modern America. Who has authority? This is week number five. Who has authority? It's all about the jurisdictions.
Foreign nations, interstate commerce, and your Indian tribes. So I'm just curious, why is it, if I'm going to put a new bathroom in my house, let's say I'm going to do a little remodeling, I'm going to add a new bathroom, I'm going to remodel a bathroom. If I call up Joe the plumber up there in Ohio and I say, hey, Joe, would you come in and do my bathroom for me? And he says, yes, he's going to come. So he's going to bring in tools. He's going to bring in some guys. I got some interstate commerce going on now, right? So the feds actually have an opportunity to make regular this transaction. What if my wife says, you know, honey, I was looking online and they've got this beautiful, fancy, you know, foo-foo toilet in France that I want to order. It's only $1,200, baby. And she's going to order this thing from, now the federal government's got an international, right? We got a foreign nation involved. So now they can make regular the transaction of my remodel in my house. So they got two opportunities there. What happens if Joe the plumber calls me and says, Rick, man, I got 15 tea parties I'm speaking at this month. There ain't no way I can get down there to do your bathroom. You're going to have to find somebody local. So I can't get Joe the plumber from Ohio, so I hire Joe Smith down the road in Dripping Springs, Texas. He's going to come do it. No tools coming in from out of state. No labor coming in from out of state. We don't have interstate commerce going on anymore. My wonderful, brilliant, gorgeous, amazing wife, as always happens, makes a brilliant decision and says, you know, honey, that'd be really foolish of us to buy that $1,200 toilet from France when Lowe's has one for $79 going to work just fine. So being as brilliant as she is, she decides we're going to do that. We don't have France involved anymore. No more international commerce, right? No more foreign nations involved. So we don't have foreign nations. We don't have interstate commerce. Why is it that the federal government gets to tell me how much water's got to go through my toilet? What kind of light bulbs I got to have in my bathroom? How wide my door's got to be? I mean, it's ridiculous. It must be because Joe Smith there next door is Choctaw. Or because, thank you, somebody got that one. Or because I'm part Comanche. I'm assuming because of me having some Comanche blood that the federal government has decided that any transaction is with an Indian trust. Surely that I can't figure it out, because there is no reason for the federal government to have anything to do with the commerce that is not fitting into any of those three categories. And you know what's really sad? The courts got this right for a long time. They slapped Congress down, slapped their hand for years when they would try to expand, open up the lid, get a new power, expand and do commerce that was not in those three categories. And then all of a sudden, they started kind of rubber stamping what would come out of Congress. And you remember why. It was FDR. He had the switch in time that saved nine, and he was going to pack the court and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, they decided, well, you know, we said a little while ago, minimum wage, you couldn't do that because that doesn't fit into the Commerce Clause, but now we're going to let you do that. And then they started letting them regulate this and regulate that. And now, you know how bad it's gotten. It's gotten so bad, the Wickard v. Filburn case. This is where a guy is farming. He is raising his own crops. He is not selling them to anybody. He's consuming them himself. He's not buying them from anybody. So there's no commerce here, right? I mean, this would be like you having a garden in your backyard. He's not buying it. No commerce. Our court said the federal government could come in with all the weight of the Department of Agriculture on this guy and say, you have to obey all of our, we can regulate everything you're doing because it's commerce. You say, well, how is it commerce that's not crossing state lines? How is it commerce if he's not even selling anything and he's not buying anything? They say, well, you know, had he bought those crops down at the farmer's market, it might have affected the price of commerce. I mean, the price of those crops. Had he sold his crops down at the farmer's market, it might have affected the price, and therefore this is somehow going to have some, some related. If you connect enough dots, it will impact interstate commerce. Friends, that's where we are. That's how far we've gone from the plain language. I mean, is anybody confused by those three categories? Anybody confused by the plain language of the Constitution? And yet, because we've gone away from what these guys told us to do, we no longer interpret that language by what they said. We let some judge somewhere else twist it a little bit, then twist it a little more, then twist it a little more. You know how bad it is now? The whole idea of taking health care through the Commerce Clause, the federal judge that initially said it was unconstitutional, he said the reason is because not only did Wickard v. Filburn allow us to regulate commerce or regulate activity that was not commerce, not only did it go so far as to allow us to regulate activity that was not commerce, what this law does is it allows us to regulate inactivity that is not commerce. And do you get how bad that is? That means we can regulate anything you do or don't do. And that's what the court said was such a bad idea. And by the way, one good thing that came out of the Supreme Court decision on health care is that Justice Roberts actually said no to using the Commerce Clause for health care. So he put the brakes on this slippery slope we've gone with the Commerce Clause. That was one of the good things that came out of it. In fact, he said, the path of our Commerce Clause decisions has not always run smooth, but it is now well established that Congress has broad authority under the clause. Hang on a second. Well established by whom? So a retired English teacher in the room, is it whom or who? Well established by, let's just go with whom because it makes it sound smart. I don't know. Well established by whom? I mean, just because the courts have said that the Commerce Clause gives broad discretion to Congress, that doesn't mean it's so. That doesn't mean that's what these guys wanted. And when you go back to what they said, they did not want it to give them broad discretion. So I completely disagree with the Chief Justice on this. It is not well established. It may be well, thought in their minds or well established in their circles, but not these guys that sat in this room. They'd be standing up and saying, oh no, you got that one entirely wrong. In fact, the other four, the four justices that dissented in the healthcare decision said this about how far this was going to go if we allowed this kind of expansion of the government.
This is Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Kennedy.
To go beyond that, meaning going beyond what happened in Wickard v. Filburn, to go beyond regulating commerce activity that is not commerce under the Constitution, but to even go even further than that, they said, and to say that the failure to grow wheat, so remember what was happening in the case. This guy was growing wheat and consuming it, so there was an activity happening, and the feds decided that that was an activity they could regulate. What they're saying is now we're going to go beyond even that and say that the failure to grow wheat. So now we're not growing wheat. And the failure to grow wheat, which is not an economic activity or any activity at all, nonetheless affects commerce. So now this guy doesn't even grow his wheat, doesn't sell it down the street, and so now we're going to be able to regulate him. They said that is to make mere breathing in and out the basis for federal prescription. It extends federal power to virtually all human activity. That's four of our Supreme Court justices saying this has gone way too far. We're using the Commerce Clause or, frankly, any part of the Constitution to regulate people just for breathing in and out. That's their words. That's how far we've allowed it to go, friends. Now, commerce is supposed to be free enterprise. The more we micromanage it, the less freedom we have. The more we force people into the marketplace, the less freedom we have. And Jefferson had a great quote on this. He said, "The pillars of our prosperity are the most thriving when left most free to individual enterprise." When we regulate to the point of micromanaging, when we force people into the marketplace, we're not left free to individual enterprise, are we? That's how far we've gone. And the reason? We hadn't been reading it. We haven't studied it. We haven't looked at what the real meaning behind those words actually are. And I don't know about you, but you know, we didn't read every clause in there in Article 1, Section 8. But I've been doing this for a few years now, and if you'll just scan there and help me out on pages 12, 14, and 16, I'm really struggling. I cannot seem to find, it's got to be in here, I'm sure it's in, I cannot seem to find the Department of Education in here. Does anybody see that? Where is the FDA in here? Anybody? What about the FTC? Anybody? There's about 14 other departments we can name, right? That aren't in here. We allowed them to open the bucket. We allowed them to make it an unlimited bucket. It's our job to get them back in the proper place, and we can do it. The system works if we'll work it. We can put them back in that proper function. So that's the dues of Congress. Those are the things they're supposed to be doing. Let's rein them in and get them back in their proper place. I know we've covered a lot of ground. Any of the stuff we've already talked about, we'll just open it up.
Can I give you some questions from?
Yeah, go ahead. Let's get some questions
from
the webinar.
We got some early ones. This first one is from Sarah Cohran in Michigan.
Michigan. We've got somebody here from Michigan, don't we? Who was it from Michigan? Yeah.
And she asks, with the Declaration of Independence declaring the violations of Great Britain, what do you say to Christians who say we don't need to vote? God is going to put in office whoever he wants.
Great question. You know, a lot of times people of faith will say, hands off. You know, if there's a higher being that's in charge of everything and raises up leaders and puts leaders down, then I don't have to do anything. And so the question from the webinar is, if these guys declared with the Declaration of Independence that Great Britain was so wrong, they were willing to take up arms against them, and these were clearly men of faith that shared that view that there was a sovereign being, then why should people of faith today get involved in government at all and try to do what we're talking about, reign in government, put it in its proper place, do our duty? What these guys said, well, in their particular case in declaring independence and actually taking up arms, they believed that that was self-defense, that it was just war under just war theory, because King George had not only reneged on the agreements but actually fired on the Americans, and so they believed that justified it. But they definitely believed that, and I love, there's two of the guys in the first Congress by the last name of Muhlenberg. They were actually pastors that also served in Congress. And one of those guys, John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg, his argument to his brother initially, because Frederick Augustus didn't want to be involved in the war, he chastised John Peter because John Peter actually took up arms. He called his men to arms from the pulpit and went out and fought, became a major general, and actually reached, I think there was only 15 that reached the rank that he did. Anyway, his brother chastised him and said, you shouldn't be getting involved. And he said, I'm a citizen of heaven, but I'm also a citizen of earth, and my freedom is as dear to me as it is to any layman. Shall I then sit still? Heaven forbid it. And he said, it's my duty to fight. And that was something these guys really understood, was the concept of duty. And I think sometimes as people of faith, we want to just step back and say God's going to take care of everything, when actually, regardless of your faith, every major religion in the world I can think of still requires you to take some sort of action at times. It requires you to do your duty. I know in my faith, I'm supposed to do my duty. I'm supposed to act on my faith. Now, faith without works is dead, right? And these guys absolutely believe that. I have lost count at the number of quotes from the founders that used that word, duty. That's something we kind of lost in our culture, that sense of duty that says you do it whether you win or lose. You do it whether it feels good or not. You do it whether it hurts your own person or your health or your economics or whatever it might be. That sense of duty, I would say to the person with the question, is why we as Christians or whatever faith you are should influence the government. It's your job to influence the culture, because this system that they put in place says we are the government. So we can't sit back and say, oh, I'm supposed to just do whatever my rulers say. No, in our system of government, says we are those rulers. So if we, the people, are the ones in charge, we have to be engaged. Yes, ma'am.
What about Exodus 18:21? That specifies it. You don't have to ask. Let's find out what that says.
That is a great point. Exodus 18:21 actually not it specifies it for us, and it gives us the guidelines. I mean, it's a great example of, and it's actually where our founders say they got our Republican form of government. You know, we say we have local, county, state, federal government. Well, it says choose out from among you leaders of tens, fifties, hundreds, thousands. That's the same thing. That's where they got the idea. And then it tells us how to choose them. What kind of folks we're looking for? We're looking for able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. So what a wonderful guideline. I actually do a blog on my website at rickgreen.com where I analyze candidates and I take a poll on my Facebook page to get people to rate candidates on those four things. Are they capable of doing the job, capable of getting elected and capable of doing the job? Do they fear God? Do they have a biblical worldview? Are they honest? Do they hate covetousness? Meaning, do they not, you know, a lot of people want the job so bad they'll do whatever it takes to stay in office. Or when you get in office, boy, the perks are so nice you want to keep them, so you do whatever. Do they hate covetousness? So anyway, I think you're exactly right. It's a great command for us and it's a great guideline for us. And I think it's a good example of saying, hey, you know, as a person of faith, sitting out is not an option. To know what to do and do nothing and say nothing, there's a right and wrong. You know something is needed to help your fellow man, to help your country, and you do nothing? Oh, man, I don't want to be that wicked and slothful servant that buried the talent, right? I want to be the one that's out there enjoying and living that talent. That's why what we're doing is so important. Because see, if you and I can go back to what these guys actually did and said, if we can learn what they really intended, and then we can go back home and we can share it with our friends and family, if we can use this knowledge in the decisions we make about who we elect to go to Congress, if we can begin to get young people to understand this and someday run for Congress, then we can get members of Congress that understand these things and we can rein this thing in. We can turn it back, folks. We can get Congress back into its proper bucket, if you will, with the lid on it. We'll just do our duties as citizens.
It is that very essence of how do we use these materials to create and glorify God that we want to secure. We said, okay, we need government for that, but not any kind of government. We've got to make government so limited and checked and balanced. And the three words they use so often, Rick, Jefferson, Madison, all of them, is divisions of power, limits on power, and then balance between the power.
It makes me think about why the founders got so detailed. I mean, for them to sit in that hot room and sweat it out and actually go through line by line, like you said earlier, post roads and all these specific details. Why did they do that? Why not just have one general statement that said government can do whatever's necessary to protect us?
They had a real distrust of power. They had been through it themselves with the king, but they've also been through it in the scriptures. And John Adams, for example, is one that in multiple letters talks about Jeremiah 17:9 as the basis for why they separated powers. Because the scripture says the heart of man is desperately wicked, who can know it? In other words, if you leave man to his own devices, it will turn bad.
Because they distrusted man.
They distrusted man. Yeah. And so man is not naturally good. You have to corral him and get him to do the right things. It's kind of funny. Who teaches two-year-olds to lie? It just comes natural.
You know? Don't have to.
There's 43 toys in a room, and the kid can have anyone, but if his sister picks up that one, who taught him selfishness? Yeah. That's just part
nature
of human nature.
Yeah.
And so they understood the nature of man, that look, there are ways you can learn self-control, but there are other times you have to exert control, because they've seen all the stuff that happened in France, they've seen Robespierre and all the stuff that went with that, they've seen the revolution in Greece, they've seen all these revolutions, and they've been under British history themselves, watching what's happened with the different kings, whether it was William and Mary, or whether it was Mary Queen of Scots, totally different approaches. So they knew history, they knew the character of man, and as John Adams said, they knew the Bible. Therefore, we separate powers and we're really specific. We're not going to just tell you general categories. We're going to tell you what you can do.
Final break of the day, folks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to At the Core with Walker Wobbin and Rick Green.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying with me. This is At the Core with Walker Wobbin and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach, sharing biblical citizenship in modern America, week 5, which is called Who Has Authority? That's the title of week 5, and it's all about the jurisdictions. What power does the federal government actually have? Let's jump right back in.
And the other reason is, you remember we were talking earlier about battle plans and battle maps. You get up
here. Yeah, looking at the bird's
30,000.
Eye view, really getting, yeah.
All right, so we're up here, and we understand that we also are creating a federal republic which shares power with lower level entities, and that's the state and communities. And so just as we have to separate power horizontally, we separate between the judiciary and the executive, and we separate it over here with the legislative. And by the way, not only do they separate powers, the Federalist Papers said that they gave each branch constitutional arms of self-defense. In other words, if that branch starts doing something you're supposed to do,
you can fight back. You've got tools in your toolbox.
Now, I will just about guarantee you ask a congressman today, name me 5 tools you have to fight back against the judiciary, and they can't tell me a thing. But the Constitution gave each branch tools to fight back. Name me five tools you have against an overreaching executive. Name me five, whatever it is.
Yeah.
The other branches don't know that anymore. And so the founders were very specific.
What a waste, because it really is a brilliant battle plan that the founders put in place to keep these.
And they wrote it all down. Yeah. You know, and I'm sure if they were here today, they'd say, are you just all illiterate?
Why aren't you using what we gave you?
Are you lazy? Yeah. I mean, this room is filled with their writings.
Yeah.
And they're online, by the way. I mean,
this
these things
you can get out.
Wasn't
a secret meeting
there.
that exposed all the secrets. You know, they gave us all the secrets.
Here it is. All the discussions in the Constitutional Convention, they're right here. And those were private discussions at the time, so they could be very candid. But they made the
public. But then they came out and said, here's what we've got for you.
Franklin's
Republic.
So it's real simple stuff. But what happens is we also have a separation of powers, not between the three branches, but between the levels of government, and that's federalism.
Yeah.
Hey, federal government, there's only certain things you can do. And by the way, state governments, here's what you can do, and local governments, here's what you do. And so that bicameralism of horizontal separation and branches, and then the vertical separation powers that Thomas Jefferson talks about are very significant. So what they did, understanding all the components that have some jurisdiction in this, they said, okay, we're going to tell you specifically what Congress can do, what the president can do, and what the judicial branch can do.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean that there's not other stuff to be done? No, there definitely is. But that's why we give you the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. And the Tenth Amendment says anything we didn't specifically give to Congress belongs to the states. We gave 18 areas to Congress. That means 4,432 areas belong to the states. That's part of the vertical separation of powers. People, they look at that and say, well, they didn't say we couldn't do it. Yeah, they did. The Tenth Amendment said if we didn't tell the government could do it, then they can't. So the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment, same with the people. You know, we told the government what they could do, but people, you got everything else that you can do.
Yeah.
So that's why they were very specific in what they did. That's why they gave us constitutional tools of self-defense. But the problem we have is if you are looking for a loophole, and you talked about the loopholes, the general welfare clause and the commerce, and all, you will find a way to bust the intent of what it is. I don't care what the intent is. I want a loophole so that I can get around it.
Yeah. And you'll change the meaning of words, do whatever it takes to get around it. Yeah.
And John Dickinson, who was not only a guy who helped put the Declaration together, but he's the guy who also signed the Constitution, one of the founding fathers, he talked about how dangerous that is when you start looking for loopholes and how it changes everything. And I'll just read here from his work. He says, nothing is more certain than that the forms of liberty may be retained when the substance is gone. Mm. In other words, you still got a constitution, but it doesn't work anymore because you had a heart transplant. You took the heart out of it and placed it with something else. He said, nothing is more certain than that the forms of liberty may be retained when the substance is gone. He said, in government as well as in religion, and then he makes a direct quote, the letter kills, but the spirit gives life. Now, that's a direct quote out of 2 Corinthians 3:6, and he notes it's right out of the Bible. He says that works in government just like it is in religion. If you forget, for example, that in religion, Jesus, in dealing with the Sabbath law, said, hey guys, don't forget, the Sabbath was made to serve you. You weren't made to serve the Sabbath. Well, you can get so into Sabbath laws that it becomes a bondage on your back, and instead of you getting the rest you need, it becomes something that's your slave driver. He said government's the same way.
Because you've gotten caught up in the legalistic letter of the law instead of the spirit of what he intended.
And so, same thing. If you get caught up in the actual wording of the general welfare clause, and if I tweak my nose just the right direction, if I tilt my shoulder
stand left, just right,
I can find an interpretation. No, remember the spirit of the general welfare clause.
Which you get by studying all this.
Which you get by studying all that. And which you laid out very clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, you had all the founders' quotes on it. Don't try to squeeze a new meaning out of this, but go to the thing, because when you do, he says, in government as well as religion, the letter kills, but the spirit gives life. And if you go to that literal word-by-word interpretation instead of what they were trying to give, you will kill the Constitution, you'll kill the country, you'll kill freedom, you'll kill prosperity, you'll kill all those things we enjoy. And that's why the founders were so good about being so specific in so many areas so that we could get the principles, apply the principles, and have the same result that we've had for 200 years.
So what do we then do if we're going to restore constitutional republic? We got to start thinking about our duty as citizens and fulfilling that role. You know, there's a lot of areas in the Constitution that speak to what the people are supposed to do, whether it's choosing your leaders, that sort of thing. And we'll get to a lot of those specific duties later. But these guys specifically told us that if you don't do your job, you're going to lose all these liberties. So when people are at home or in their churches or wherever they are studying this, they need to think about it in terms of, this is doing my part to literally save the nation. This is not a small thing. When you're studying the Constitution, you're planning to save the country.
Well, the question was asked, you know, since God's going to do all this, why do we have to get involved?
Yeah.
And there's that, always that fun story that's out there about the flood that comes, and the guy crawls up on top of his house and he prays God, deliver me from flood. And, you know, here comes a helicopter. Hey, climb on, we'll get you out. Now God's going to send me deliverance. And here comes a guy in a rowboat, and hey, climb in the rowboat. Now God's going to send me. And three of those things. And then finally the waters come and the guy drowns. And he's in heaven and says, God, I prayed that you'd save me. What happened? Well, I sent you a helicopter, I sent you a boat, and you did nothing with it.
Yeah.
And so this notion that because God's in charge, we have to do nothing is absolute heresy from a faith perspective.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing in Scriptures that justifies you sitting on your tail and doing nothing.
He has sent us a great Declaration of Independence, a great Constitution, a great system.
And even from a religious standpoint, if everybody in the world is going to come to Christ, why do we need missionaries? Why does he give us the Great Commission and say, you guys go do it? I'll just do it from heaven.
Right.
Just, you know, all of that is pure stupidity. But I love the way the Founding Fathers dealt with this. John Witherspoon, he himself is a minister of the gospel, and these are his original writings, and he deals with this issue. This is the mentality that's been there forever, and so he deals with this. Hey, look, God's in charge of government. Why should we get involved? Now, in our particular case, we're a stewardship government, but I just want to read you some of the logic that he applied here. You know, people say, we don't need to get involved. God's in charge. He says, shall we establish nothing good because we know it can't be eternal? I mean, your house is going to fall over eventually, so why even build one at all? Why live indoors? Because it's going to...
Oh, no, wait. I remember this one. Why should I clean my room, Mom? It's going to get dirty.
Exactly. That same logic. He says, shall we live without government because every constitution has its old age and period? Because we know that we shall die, shall we take no pains to preserve or lengthen our life? You know, I'm going to die someday, so I'll never see a doctor in my life. I'll never go see a dentist. You know,
and I'll eat all the junk food I want because I'm going to die anyway.
Something's growing there, but I don't care what it is. I'm going to die anyway. We don't think like that any other area in life. Why would we think like that in government? And that's what he says. He says, far from it, sir. It only requires the more watchful attention to settle government upon the best principles and in the wisest manner that it may last as long as in the nature of things will admit. I mean, it's got to die.
I love that phrase, too, more watchful attention. Mm-hmm. That's what we're doing.
Because it is going to someday die, you pay more attention right now because it won't last forever. But you do want to, you know, I'm going to die someday, but I'd rather it be when I'm in the 90s than when in my teens.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do some things too. Same with government. Government is not eternal. It will not be eternal. But wouldn't you rather have a government that lasts over 2 centuries, maybe 3 centuries, maybe 4 centuries, than being like France has had 15 constitutions in the same period of time we've had one?
Yeah.
Or being in South Korea where they've had 6 constitutions since 1948? Or being in Poland, that if you're 90 years old in Poland today, you've lived through 7 revolutions and 7 constitutions.
Wow.
Wouldn't you a whole lot rather have it where well, that means we've got to get involved. And you know, you use the term duty a minute ago and talking about the founders and founders on duty. And that is a term that, from a faith perspective, and that question was asked, well, since God's going to do it, why do we need to do anything? It is interesting that the term duty is something that is specifically addressed in the Bible. Jesus himself, when his disciples were having trouble doing what he was doing, performing the same miracles, they came to him in Luke 17 and said, Lord, increase our faith. I mean, we just can't do. And his answer to them to increase our faith was, he told them a whole parallel about learning to do your duty. If you want to be mature, you learn to do your duty. This is a word the Founding Fathers used repeatedly, time and again. Let me just give you some of their quotes on duty. Here's Sam Adams. Sam Adams says, the man who is conscientiously doing his duty, and by the way, the easiest way to define duty is that which you ought to do, whether you feel like it, want to, or anything else. Doing your duty is doing the right thing, whether it's convenient, whether it's easy, whether you want to, it's just doing the right thing, period. So he said, the man who is consciously doing his duty, that is doing the right thing, will ever be protected by that righteous and all-powerful being, and when he's finished his work, he'll receive an ample reward. In other words, God's given you a country. He said, you're the stewards over this country. You guys take care of it till I get back. Luke 19:13 says, occupy till I come. So do it. Do what you're supposed to. And if you do your duty, if you're conscientious in doing what you can do to make this thing last as long as it can, then he says, you'll when you finish your work, you'll receive an ample reward. And that is what we know out of passages, particularly in Luke and Matthew, where the servants are called before the master. He said, I gave you trust. What'd you do with it? And they said, we didn't do nothing with it. He said, you're in serious trouble. We've been given a country. Yeah. And if we decide we're going to check out, we're in trouble. Here's another founding
father.
We've been given those principles. John Hancock, he says, and having secured the approval of our hearts by a faithful and unwearied discharge of our duty to our country. And this is interesting. He says, if you'll do what's right, your heart will approve it. Your heart will say, you know, nobody has bought into that. You lost the election, but you did the right thing. And so your conscience says you did everything you could. Yeah. He says, and having secured the approval of our hearts by faithful and unwearied discharge of our duty to our country, he said, let us joyfully leave our concerns in the hands of him who raises up and pulls down the empires and kingdoms of the world as he pleases. In other words, we don't do our duty because it turns out right. God's going to worry about how it turns out. Yeah, every constitution eventually going to die,
yeah.
But that's all right. I tried to keep it alive as long as I could, and we're going to let God worry about when it all dies. And so that's our part. We do that. Here's another good quote from John Jay. John Jay, author of the Federalist Papers, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He said, all that the best men can do is to persevere in doing their duty to their country and leave the consequences to him who made it their duty. You just do what's right. God will worry about how it works out. He says, be neither elated by success, however great, nor discouraged by disappointment, however frequent and mortifying.
Mm. Well, we need to hear that
That's it.
Whether the election goes great or the election goes terrible, we still keep on keeping on.
You know, what we've said for a long time, I've been involved in politics a long time, you have too, is, you know, the problem with conservatives is, if they lose an election, they'll pick up their ball and go home. But the problem with conservatives is, if they win an election, they'll pick up their ball and go home.
Yeah, they think that's over, one battle.
We did not. But I love what he said. If you'll do your duty, then you're not going to have the highs and lows. You're not going to be elated by success. You're not going to be disappointed by frequent and mortifying losses.
Back up to the first part of that quote again. So what you started with earlier, a lot of people in the question we got there at Independence Hall, is if God's going to take care of everything anyway, I don't do anything. That's the opposite concept of we do everything we can.
That's right.
All that the best men can do, we do our duty, we persevere, knowing he is going to, in the end, take care of everything.
Yep.
But in the meantime, right now, I'm supposed to do everything he's called me to do.
Well, we get rewards and punishments from him based on what we do, not what everybody else does.
Yeah.
And so if everybody else screws up the nation and it goes under, that's their problem. But I'm not going to be part of that. I'm going to at least get some kudos from him, well done, good and faithful servant, because I got in there and try to do something,
yeah.
As opposed to you lazy and slothful servant. You did nothing with what I gave you. That's not what I want to hear. And so that's what they understood. One more, and by the way, he said, we must go home to be happy, and our home is not in this world. Mm. And that's why people say, oh, you know, God's going to take care of it. I'm heaven bound. Yeah. He says, here we have nothing to do but our duty, and by it to regulate our business and our pleasures. If you're looking to be happy and uninvolved, maybe in heaven, but not here.
Yeah.
Here, you've got to regulate what you do by your duty. And then Witherspoon said it this way. He said, the sum of the whole is that the blessing of God is only to be looked for by those who are not lacking or wanting in the discharge of their own duty.
Mm.
So, all right. God's going to take care of it. I don't know how it's going to turn out. In the meantime, I've got to bust my tail to do everything I can. Every election, and this is, I hope folks will make a commitment on this, that every time the doors are open for an election, you show up.
Yeah.
Because right now, in city elections and school board elections, only 3-6% of Americans show up.
3-6%.
Yeah, we think every four years, I'll vote for the president.
3-6 out of 100.
3-6%.
Yeah.
And so, all this wacky stuff that's going at local, and people wrongly think we get healthy from the top down. No, you don't. You get healthy from the bottom up. You go take your local school boards, you go take your city councils and your mayor's races and your public utility seats, and from that you create a farm team whereby you start getting good state reps and good state senators who will eventually run for governor and Congress. It takes a while to get healthy from the bottom up.
But it works.
And it works.
And we see it happen. We've seen pockets of this,
and
even right now in the current environment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so your commitment should be one duty I will do is I'm going to vote every time there's an election. I'm going to find out about it. It's a constitutional amendment election. I don't know what's on the ballot. I'm going to find out. So do that. But the other thing is read, study, teach, know, defend, and assert.
Yeah.
That's our duty to do that. And if we do that, it will make a big difference.
Before we close out, can I see that Witherspoon again? Was it Witherspoon, the quote that you gave earlier? There was a phrase where he was talking about being watchful.
It only requires the more watchful attention.
Okay, that's what watchful attention. So that's what we've got to have more of in every single area of our
government.
And
he said, local. Because it is going to come to an end someday, we should have the more watchful attention. Yeah. So he's admitting the fact that it's not permanent, but that's why we're more diligent and more watchful. And that watchful attention, you're right, that's a great term.
Well, there you have it, folks. We're going to have more watchful attention in every area of our government. In our next chapter here on, in Constitutional Live, we're going to get into the presidency. How can we have more watchful attention to the presidency and make sure it's constitutional? By studying what Article 2 in the Constitution says about it when we come back here on Constitutional Live with David Barton.
Well, we'll have to learn about the president on another day because we are out of time for today. I hope you've enjoyed this. It's a mix of Constitutional Live and Biblical Citizenship in Modern America, and the entire thing is free at PatriotAcademy.com. Thanks for listening to At the Core.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.